Well, hello, my friends, and welcome back. My name is Stephanie Safarian, and you're listening to episode 449 of Sustainable Minimalists. If you're new here and you're like, what the heck is this show? This is a show about intentional and eco-friendly minimalist living. On today's show, we are discussing consumer culture, yes, and we're specifically discussing the consequences associated with excessive convenience. Excessive convenience. Here in America, we're overworked, we're exhausted, convenience culture is strong. I believe that we are now veering into excessive convenience. And excessive convenience, of course, comes with a host of personal, societal, environmental problems. So that's what we're discussing today. Here to help me do that is Jennifer Newton. Jennifer is a historian of consumer culture, and she is also the brains behind the Sustain Initiative Substack. It's a newsletter, and it is, oh my goodness, so good. She talks about what we talk about on the show every week, but she does it better. Jennifer, I'm so excited to talk to you. How are you?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I came across your Substack and I thought to myself, we need to chat. Holy moly. Let's start by you telling us who you are and how you found yourself writing about consumerism, consumerist culture, convenience culture, which we're going to talk about today. Like, these are very niche topics, and I'm always so excited when I stumble across somebody who has the same interests and passions I am. So how did you get here?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my name is Jennifer Newton. I'm a writer. I'm a mom to two toddlers, but I'm actually a historian by training. So my undergraduate and my graduate level research both focused on the history of consumer culture, so how advertisements reflected and dictated culture at various times, and also how people, especially those from marginalized groups, used consumer purchases to make broader political and social statements. But I took a step back from my career when my oldest was born in 2020. So I started writing online about kind of the other avenue of this passion, which is sustainability and intentional living. So it's been a really great and fun outlet for all my creative energy, and I'm just really passionate about helping others tackle consumerism and low-waste lifestyle changes.
I love it. Oh, we're destined to be friends, Jennifer, because I mean, I'll be honest, like in my personal daily life, nobody wants to talk about overconsumption. Nobody wants to talk about low-waste living. So this is giving me life. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, people kind of give you a side eye when you start talking about this too much. So it is a little bit segmented. Like, you have to go searching for me to know that this is something I like write about as frequently as I do.
Well, today we're talking about convenience culture. We've talked about it on the show before, listeners, but I wanted to cover it again because there's convenience, right? Like, and we all benefit from some level of convenience in our lives. But then there's an excessive level of convenience, excessive convenience. And I think that's where we're at in American society today. Excessive convenience, I believe you're going to make the point today, excessive convenience is detrimental not only to ourselves on a personal level, but to society as a whole. So let's start by talking about that convenience industrial complex. I was introduced to it through your Substack. So what is the convenience industrial complex and how did we get here?
Yeah, absolutely. That is such a great question. I think the first part is you're right. We all rely a little bit on convenience, right? So I have two toddlers. I'll be honest, sometimes the idea of taking them into the grocery store is my worst nightmare, right? So I'm not going to pretend that I've never done grocery delivery because I have. But I think that there's a difference between saying, okay, this is the day where like convenience is the difference between having a mental breakdown and not. And then this idea that we need to Amazon Prime everything or DoorDash everything and everything needs to show up the very next day on our doorstep. And that's where this idea of kind of convenience culture occasionally becomes really excessive, right? When it separates us from our community. And so you kind of mentioned like, how did we get here? And so part of this is over the past several decades, we've really equated consumerism with American patriotism. And so we have this idea that anytime we're shopping, it's for the good of our communities. It's good for the good of our national economy. And this is really, really apparent if we think about our public policy responses to disasters, right? We're most frequently told to go shopping. So in the aftermath, for example, of the September 11th terrorist attacks, then President Bush urged Americans to, quote, get down to Disney World in Florida and enjoy life the way we want it to be enjoyed. Well, 20 years later, in the midst of COVID-19, the number one policy goal was to maintain confidence in spending in the American economy. And so this kind of narrative that we've been sold is if you're buying things, literally anything, right? It doesn't matter if it's a $2 t-shirt, a $20,000 like boat, right? Doesn't matter. You're keeping the economy afloat. And we're told that that's always a good thing. But I think it's really important as a historian, right, to situate this a little bit historically and to say that that's actually a pretty new belief we have as a culture. And so we started to see a real rise in the kind of convenience culture type products, everything from drive-throughs and packaged food in the 1950s. But some people, and especially some political leaders, really still weren't sold on it, right? They didn't immediately go, this is some great thing. In 1961, for example, then President Eisenhower had a really famous farewell address. And he was actually a Republican at the time, right? So also our kind of political positions on this have shifted. But he shared in his farewell address a concern that we must, quote, avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren. And what's absolutely crazy about this, right, is we can't imagine any politician saying that today, because we've got so many economic forces, big businesses, big investors, who always expect to see this like robust, unsustainable growth at all times. And these big businesses have really latched onto like, how can we make things a little bit easier for consumers, right? And so if you can get another sale with a drive-through, with a mobile order, with somebody who drives 30 minutes for a pizza, right? Businesses are like, okay, great, I'm making another $10. But then for us as individuals, right, that's not necessarily what's best for us. And that's also not what's necessarily best for the environment. But because we're told this, that we're always like buying things is doing good, right, is kind of this message that we're being sent. But that's virtue signaling, right? So if I buy a flag t-shirt, that's not the same thing as donating to the families of fallen firefighters. But we're sold this idea that like the two are morally equivalent. And so that's how we kind of reach this point where any purchasing is good purchasing.
Yes. I really appreciate that you gave a bit of history there, especially with the connection between consumption of stuff and American patriotism. We see this throughout history. You mentioned the pandemic and 9/11, but also I believe World War II, even World War I. I mean, there was a change happening there in which the message at first was conserve, save, do with what you've got or go without. And then the message became buy to rev up the economic engine. And we hear the economic engine's argument all the time, the economy being number one. I mean, if you listen to President Biden's State of the Union address just last week, economy over all else. And the all else that we're forgetting there is the planet that we all live on and call each other home. So if we're making the point today that excessive convenience is detrimental to ourselves personally and society as a whole, I mean, it's a surprise to none of my listeners when we pursue excessive convenience in the form of stuff and in the form of, you know, fast deliveries, auto checkout, et cetera, like the detriment to society is in large part detriment to our planet. But let's talk about the detriments to ourselves on a personal level. You mentioned that excessive convenience separates us from our community. Can you talk more about that and tell us, well, why is that a problem?
Yeah, absolutely. Convenience is what happens really when we operate in a society where we have to fend for ourselves. And so that it's this idea that I have a sick kid, but a neighbor doesn't bring a casserole, so I resort to pizza delivery. And every time I kind of use this convenience culture, I'm also taking another step back away from my community, right? Because if my pizza and my packages are showing up at my door, well, I'm not having to talk to anybody, right? I'm not having to go out and deal with the friction of actually interacting with somebody else, in a checkout line or smiling at a stranger. And those are connections that are actually like pretty important for us socially, like from a health perspective. Just like we think that what we need are really strong connections, right? We think that we need like intimate, close friendships, and we do. But the other thing that we need is what people really call weak ties. And so those are the people that you don't know very well. You might not even know their name, but they're people that you kind of orbit around. And so it's the mailman, the person you pass by walking. And scientists have actually found, and doctors have found, that the better predictors for health are the number of weak ties you have. And so especially moving, for example, older individuals moving into old age, it's a better reflection of their physical health, of their lack of cognitive decline, if they have a lot of these people that they're spending, you know, a couple minutes every couple of days around. So it's not the person you're pouring out your heart to, but it's connections that really do matter.
I love that distinction between strong ties and weak ties. And you aptly mentioned there that the weak ties matter. Just this morning, I wasn't prepared to share this on today's show, but it fits so perfectly with what you're saying. I opted into, you know, voting by home for my town's local election, which is coming up. And I'm not saying there's any problems with mail in your ballot. I'm all about get out the vote. Mail in your ballot if you have mobility issues or transportation issues is A++, okay? But I don't have mobility issues and I don't have transportation issues, and there's no reason that I could not get to the polling center on election day. However, out of convenience, I opted in for the mail-in ballot. And I'm filling it in today and I'm thinking to myself, this is another example of me staying in my home in my sweatpants when there's benefits to be had by going out and talking to the polling person and saying hello to the policeman who stands outside the door and, you know, getting out in society. The excessive convenience that we're talking about today, what it's doing to me on a personal level is it's shrinking my sphere of community, let's say. It's all but eliminating those weak ties, which you aptly mentioned are really important for wellness. And so I'm curious about what your thoughts on social media are, because at least for me personally, I don't have strong ties on social media, but I certainly have some weak ones. How does social media fall into this connections conversation we're having? I do know on your Substack, you call social media a digital pacifier, and oh my God, I love it. Talk to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you make a really great point that social media is all about weak ties. But I think that what's really pernicious about it is that social media doesn't announce, oh, these are really weak ties. It makes you think that what these are actual friends, right? But what you actually have on social media are followers, right? You have readers or you have people clicking like. You don't often have kind of real true connections on social media. And they actually don't even come with the health benefits that a weak tie does in real life. Because what's so powerful about a weak tie in real life is that you have a little bit of friction in that conversation. You have the smiles, you have the hugs, right? And those are things that aren't happening on social media, right? If you disappear from social media, somebody might randomly reach out and be like, are you okay? But really, like, most people wouldn't notice or care. But social media is also kind of in the process eroding all of this actual culture and connection. Because we think that we're getting connection on social media. So we think, oh, we don't need it somewhere else. But the average social media user spends more than 2 hours a day on the platform. That's time that isn't being devoted to anything else. And so when you think of like social clubs historically, you think of elite and exclusionary country clubs. But in reality, for much of the 20th century, Americans from all walks of life formed all these smaller self-created organizations, so gardening clubs, bridge clubs, book clubs, mutual aid societies. Friendships of community connections were really tangible, right? They had this real impact on your life. And of course, we still have some of those today, right? You can still be a part of a mom's group or a book club or whatever, but we don't have nearly as many of these organizations. And so what we've really started to do is replace these kind of community gatherings and hobbies, these third spaces outside of our home, with time spent scrolling. But anytime I'm scrolling, I'm not actually connecting with others, and I'm not creating. And creating has these really powerful benefits for the brain, right? Boosting self-esteem, reducing the risk of anxiety and depression, and also really powerful benefits for community, right? So think about all the incredible music and art that would never be created if people spent all that time on their phone instead of actually doing the creating. And here, the creating is not about your skill level, right? No one expects you to pick up a paintbrush for the first time and be a Picasso, but you're still getting all of the benefits of your hobby, of your connection, just by starting the activity. And social media really kind of takes you away from feeling the need to even start that activity, right? Why should I go to a dance class if I can see somebody dancing on TikTok?
Yeah. I'm thinking about how in a culture that prioritizes economics above all else, so many of us feel the need to monetize our creations. And therefore, then social media becomes a means by which we tell everybody else about perhaps what we've created, and in hopes that like it gets likes and followers and this and that, in hopes that we somehow numerize, digitize the thing to show that it's worthy. Or we're not creating anything because we're mindlessly scrolling on social media, seeing what everybody else is promoting. And I know that's a quite simplistic view of social media, but it seems like everybody's just throwing out their stuff into the void. They're throwing it on the social media wall in hopes that some of it sticks. That to me does not scream real connection.
Yeah, not at all. And I think the other thing that you really touched on there is that the institutions that are benefiting monetarily from our labor really are the social media platforms, right? So they want more content. They don't really care what the content is. It can be really poor quality content as long as it's generating more likes. And so that actually also kind of decreases the quality of what you put out in the world, right? You need the bare minimum to get likes and shares. It's not about the best content you can put out because you're having to churn out so much content to try to stay relevant on Instagram Reels or whatever the new thing is. And I'm not super into social media at this point, so I can't even tell you what the latest thing is, right? But it becomes this kind of hamster wheel that small individual creators have to stay on to stay relevant. Most of the monetary benefit of that is going to the big Metas and TikToks.
And also too, you know, so if we're putting out our creation, let's say whatever it is, maybe it's a song, maybe it's a photograph, maybe it's a podcast episode, whatever it is, we're putting it out on social media, we're throwing it against the wall into the void, hoping that we get some positive feedback back in the forms of likes or comments or shares or whatever it is, and we get none, then how many of us take that lack of feedback and apply it to the quality of the creation or even to our self-worth? And then how many of us give up on creating altogether because it didn't get any positive feedback? But there's still benefit to creating and doing stuff, even if it's not getting that feedback, even if it's not good. Like, I'm a horrible singer, but I sing in the shower. Just because I'm not good at it doesn't mean I should stop singing, because I still get enjoyment from being a horrible singer in the shower. You don't have to be good at something. You don't have to get feedback from others. If you enjoy it, you can still do it anyway.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting is for people who are old enough to have a memory of a time before social media, right? You might be a little bit disconnected from your hobbies now. You might have to re-find yourself, but you at least have this framework for like, what it would look like to live in a world where you get to just enjoy your hobbies and you don't have to monetize it or perform it. But one of the places where I, and I think a lot of other people too, are just really increasingly concerned about social media is the effect on kids and teenagers who don't have that point of reference, who are growing up in this world where what's the point of anything you do if it's not generating these likes and this kind of very visceral, immediate feedback from the people around you. And so then it's a lot harder for them to say like, okay, what do I pursue even if I'm not good at it? Because you're looking around and you're seeing these people who you think are your peers, right? But they actually might be influencers who are making a lot of money to give off this performative impression of their life. But you're like, oh, they're so good at this thing. And so why can't I be good at this? And I shouldn't even try because I'm not them. And I think that that's kind of a direction that culture at large is heading with social media. And that's really concerning to me.
And of course, it goes without saying, too, that culture, in this case, in the confines of what we're talking about, convenience culture, by any sort of societal value is perpetuated through social media. So I'll leave that there. We're going to take our sponsor break, Jennifer. But when we come back, I want to talk about some other ways in which culture perpetuates itself. We're going to go to mass media, specifically television, next, listeners. So stay tuned. We'll be back after our quick sponsor break. If you've been paying attention, you've likely heard something about gut health and why zoning in on your gut health is so darn important. You need EQ's Daily Women's Microbiome Defense. It's a 3-in-1 capsule that supports your digestive health and promotes gut barrier protection. I started taking EQ's Daily Women's Microbiome Defense because I have a bloating problem, friends. Yes, I do. Inflammation is not my friend. Since taking one capsule a day on an empty stomach with water, I have noticed more energy, improved skin, and here's the big one, reduced bloating. Head to myeq.com and use code SUSTAINABLE for 15% off Equilibria's microbiome defense and so much more. That's myeq.com and use code SUSTAINABLE at checkout for 15% off site-wide today. And we're back. Today, I'm speaking with Jennifer Newton. She is a historian of consumer culture, and she is also the brains behind the Sustain Initiative Substack. Listeners, go follow her Substack right now. I will link to it in the show notes. So many good reads there. So thank you, Jennifer. Before the break, we were talking about social media not only as a perpetuator of culture, but also social media as a place in which, so we're like stepping back from society. We're not seeing as many people. We're staying home more in the name of convenience. And then we're replacing that much needed connection with human beings, and we're doing it digitally. We're doing it online. What are the consequences of that? That was before the break. Now we're on to another way in which culture perpetuates itself, which of course is mass media. I read on your Substack, Jennifer, that the average American home has more televisions than people. I had no idea. And let me just pause and say, my grandparents' house, like when I was growing up in the 90s, my grandparents had 8 TVs in their home for 2 people. And I thought that was crazy, even as a kid. More TVs than people, that's amazing. What are your thoughts, though, on simply just watching less television as a means of stepping away from a convenience culture that perhaps isn't aligned with your values?
Yeah. So first, can I say the 8 TVs thing is absolutely shocking. It's making me mentally count how many TVs my grandparents had. And I actually think they had 5, so not that much better. But it's how many TVs can you possibly watch, right? Are you running from one room to the next? Like, I've got this one show here, one show there. So I think that's just a really fascinating thing. But I'm not personally much of a television person. I didn't even own a TV until a few years ago. And my family uses it just for sports and a couple of favorite shows. But a couple of things come to mind. The first and kind of most obvious one, we've talked a little bit about this, is anytime I'm watching TV, I'm consuming rather than creating. And I'm not really concerned about an adult who spends an hour like decompressing every couple of days. But the average American actually spends more than 4 hours a day watching TV. That's a number that's generally risen over time as the number of available television shows has expanded exponentially. And also streaming services have incorporated features like autoplay and dropping entire seasons at once that's encouraging binge watching. So if you're watching as much television as the average American, right, more than 4 hours a day, and you lived to a statistically average 78 years old, you'll spend nearly 15 years of your life watching television. And I think the only really question I have there is, like, what better thing could you do with 15 years of your life? What's anything else that you could do with such a really big fraction of time. But it doesn't look that way to us right now. Like, I don't sit down in front of my TV being like, here goes 15 years, right? You sit down innocently going, I'm just going to watch this one show that turns into two, that turns into five. And I think that that's part of what's tricky about it, right? It seems harmless until you add up all the time.
Right. And you can quantify the time, but you may not be able to quantify the ways in which your views on life, your behavior are changing, right? Because that's more subtle. I will say for listeners who have been following along with my own journey to significantly scale back the amount of television my children watch, this has been about a year in the making. And Jennifer, I'll just catch you up and say that my kids were watching a good amount of TV, and it just became the culture in the household that the TV went on as I was cooking dinner. It was one show, then it was two shows, and then it was, you know, Saturday morning cartoons. And then it was just like snowballing into them watching an awful lot of TV. And I'm not, like, I don't have any problems with TV, but I do have problems with the amount of time that my children personally were watching TV, because what could they be doing instead? You mentioned creating Legos, drawing. My youngest daughter is now trying to learn how to knit. Like, there's so much other things that they could be doing. And so I didn't tell them they weren't going to be watching much TV anymore. I just started redirecting them when they asked. Now, a year later, they no longer ask, and they don't watch much TV at all anymore. It wasn't that hard of a change. They know how to redirect themselves now, I think is the best way to put it. Instead of asking, they go create. And I say all that to say that now when the TV does go on, it's so much more apparent to me the subliminal messaging and the values that are being imparted through, in this case, children's television shows that I might not necessarily be on board with. Like, if we're watching it every day, those messages, the culture that's being perpetuated through the TV is lost to me because it's just what we do. We watch TV every day. The TV goes on at dinner, let's say. But now that the TV is not on at dinner, when it does go on, I see so much more of what's actually going on there, if that makes any sense.
That makes complete sense. And it's so tricky as a parent, because if you're trying to use a television for that kind of crunch moment, like when you're making dinner or something, the entire point is that you don't have to be sitting there observing every single second of TV. But then if you glance over and you're like, what is this? Is this really a kid's show? Why is it on Nickelodeon? Well, that's concerning, right? And it's something that as parents, it's hard to regulate. But other people aren't exactly stepping in to regulate exactly in line with our values. And I will say my kids are younger than yours, but what's really interesting is we have at this point in time, and I'm sure it'll get a little more loose eventually, but at this point we have a, other than when we, like as a family, turn on football or something, we have a, you only get TV when you're sick. And so my almost four-year-old actually interprets this, because this is the bar, as if I throw up, then I get to watch Bluey. And so she'll say that every once in a while. She'll be like, I get to watch Bluey when I throw up. It's like, okay, yeah, you do. But because we don't have it as part of the everyday culture of our house, it never occurs to her to ask for TV. And that's something that I do think also reflects a level of privilege that we're in a position to direct them to other things, that we're in a position to kind of be in that space. Like, I absolutely recognize that there are times when people need a TV or an iPad to facilitate that difficult moment if you're solo parenting or anything like that. Like, I'm never going to judge somebody for handing it over for a little bit. But I think that as a culture, we've become so okay and so accustomed to, okay, let's just make our kid be quiet with the TV or the iPad. And that's the part that's really tricky, is how do we take a step back from the culture of that being our first and our most immediate response to any child's discomfort.
Yes. I think it's important for children to be bored. I think it's important for children to learn how to sit with boredom instead of curing boredom immediately with a screen, with a tablet, or in an adult's case, a phone. I know for me, every time I get bored or I have a down minute, Instead of just sitting, taking a breath, looking at the window, what do? I pick up my phone and it's a problem. Like I fully admit it's a problem. I'm working on it, but I don't want that for my kids. I want my kids to be able to sit with a moment of quiet and not feel the need to pick up a screen. So, all right. So we talked about social media. We talked about TV. The number one way in which culture perpetuates itself, in my humble opinion, is through parenting, child rearing, how we're raising our children. Because our children, they're the next generation, right? They are observing what you and I are doing every single day, and they will perhaps later mimic what they see their parents doing, what they've grown up around. So I guess, you know, you can divulge as much or as little as you'd like, Jennifer, but how are you seeking to not perpetuate the aspects of convenience culture that, you know, you might not agree with? How are you seeking to not perpetuate convenience culture in your role as a mom in your own home?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think the first thing that you brought up about boredom being important, I absolutely agree. And so I do spend a lot of time playing with my kids. They're 2 and almost 4, but they don't own pretty much anything that will just entertain them. We don't have any flashing lights. We don't have batteries. So there's no kind of access to like technology where they're just really sitting passively for any real amount of time. And so they've got their toys that they can play with and puzzles. We do lots of outside play in the dirt, going on nature walks, pick your own blackberries. So the kind of things that try to really connect them with their bodies, with nature, in ways that you're just not getting if you're sitting inside. The other thing that I really try to emphasize is delayed gratification. And so it's the idea that, obviously in age-appropriate ways, you're never going to ask a six-month-old to exercise delayed gratification. But as they get older, like, okay, so you want your milk cup filled? As soon as I finish this bite of food, I'll get it for you. That might not be instantaneous. And as they go to the store, this one's a really big one for me, is I will never buy anything for my kids the first time they go to a store and ask for it. They can take a picture with it. They can put it on a birthday list or a Christmas list. But there's no amount of fit throwing or requesting that will get it at that moment. And so we actually, not too long ago, came back from a vacation where the girl's great-grandma had given them $5 to spend while we were down there. And of course, $5 doesn't go terribly far, right? So we knew that as parents, we'd have to kind of match that for them to get something quality out of the deal. But my almost 4-year-old spent the whole week very carefully, when we were in any store or museum, going, well, I have this money and how should I spend it? And so we talked about, well, what are the things that you've been wanting already? Okay, you like this, but would you play with it? Maybe not. And so it took her the entire week. And we even had conversations about, if you don't find anything here, that's okay. We can find you something somewhere else, right? But it took her the whole week to very carefully pick out this little like wooden horse and pig that she just is absolutely infatuated with. But it's that kind of care and reflection that I try to model to them. Of course, I'm not always perfect at it, but I try to model and I try to teach them to wait for the thing that they really want, the thing that will really add value, right? So don't just jump for the very first thing that you see. The other thing that I try to do to not perpetuate convenience culture is to really involve them in household tasks. And so they're still pretty young, but they help put away their own clothes. They help me unload the dishwasher. We've got blackberry bushes outside. And so the whole summer is, oh, are the blackberries ready today? Let's go pick these. And we do a lot of cooking and baking from scratch. And of course, it's not every day, but it's enough to try to make them reflective of like, this is the time and effort that's going into what we make. And so even if there's a day where you have like a frozen pizza or whatever, okay, like they know that somewhere somebody had to put an effort to make that pizza happen, right? It's not something that just magically shows up at your doorstep. It takes this time and energy and resources to create this thing. And they have their own personal experience trying to create something similar.
I love that. I want to come over. Well, as you're talking there, I'm thinking to myself, There's a line for everybody. Like you mentioned aptly at the beginning of our conversation, sometimes our lives are just at a place where we need convenience. Yet other times, aka me with my ballot, my voting ballot, like I did not need to pursue the ultra convenient option there. And so I'm going to read you, and this might be awkward for you, but you wrote something on your Substack that really hit me. And so I'm going to read it out loud for listeners. And your words are, as individuals, we have to decide what parts of convenience make sense for our lives and our families and where we should push back. Think twice about two-day shipping, passing on DoorDash, supporting your local coffee shop by lingering on a Saturday morning, turning off the car while waiting at curbside pickup. As with every other change we talk about in this space, it's not about making all the changes or doing something perfectly. It's about one degree better. End quote. I love it. How can listeners best decide, what parts of convenience make sense for them versus what's excessive convenience? I know the line's different for everybody, but do you have any thoughts on listeners just finding their line?
Absolutely. That's such a great question. I think the first thing that comes to mind is figure out the exact stage of life that you're in and the pressure points around it. And so that's the part that's going to be different for everybody, but you can probably identify which parts of your day or your week feel the worst. And so if the worst part of your week is taking your toddler into Walmart, right, then maybe that's the place where you use convenience, right? If the hardest part, but a lot of this too is also pre-planning, right? So if the hardest part of your day is running out of diapers, well, that's something that you can kind of pre-plan and anticipate. If the hardest part of your day is dinner, that doesn't always have to mean DoorDash or takeout. It can also mean meal prepping, right? So knowing in advance what you can throw in the crock pot or batch cooking. So for example, before the birth of both of my girls, right, I kind of rallied in that third trimester when you're still not too pregnant, but you're doing okay. And, you rally and you make a bunch of stuff for the freezer. And so that's a totally different situation than if an illness unexpectedly hits your family and you're in crunch mode and you can't plan ahead, right? That's the time where you do what it takes and you do the takeout, whatever. But if you have a little bit of notice that there's going to be this time that's coming up that's hectic, right? Birth of a child, a big move. Those are the kinds of places where you can say, what shifts can I make to anticipate the problems that will show up and to try to make it a little bit easier without relying on that two-day shipping or the DoorDash or the whatever. And I think too, giving yourself a lot of grace. And so we don't need just a few people who are never using convenience and who are doing zero waste perfectly or anything like that. What we really need is millions or even billions of people who are being just a little bit more reflective, right? Who are taking the shifts, just a couple shifts at a time. And these shifts often feel hard the first time you do them, right? So if you're switching from, the shampoo that you grab on the store shelf to a zero waste shampoo bar, that's a shift that feels really hard when you first do it because you have to figure out where to buy it, will you like it, get it there. But as soon as you've made the shift, it becomes easy, right? It becomes something that you just know that's the product you're using. You buy it every 6 months. You even subscribe to it on an individual retailer's website, right? There's all sorts of things that you can do to reduce the friction after the original decision. And so a lot of times it's just the original decision that's hard, and everything after that is as easy as going about your ordinary life before the change. And so it's kind of timing those out to say, I don't have to make all the changes at once, but what are a few changes that are manageable today, a few that are manageable next week or next month?
Such great tips there, Jennifer. And as you're talking, I was thinking about, for me personally, so how do I know my line in the sand? And I think, at least in my life, it comes down to knowing myself. Like I hear all the time the advice, just throw money at the problem. If you're overwhelmed and you have extra money, just throw money at the problem. Like you're sick of cleaning your house, hire a cleaner, throw money at the problem, or you're hosting Easter dinner, throw money at the problem, just have it catered. But knowing myself means that I'm pretty frugal. And so throwing money at the problem actually turns me away from convenience. Because guess what? Convenience culture often comes with a financial premium. It's more expensive to cater Easter dinner than it is for me to cook it myself, often in the hundreds of dollars, right? And I just say that to say that sometimes I do throw money at problems, and when I am ready, willing, and able to throw money at the problem, aka, you know, invest in the convenient option, I know then that I'm doing that for the right reasons because I found my line. if that speaks to anybody, but let's not forget, convenience comes with a hefty price tag, often, if not always.
It does. I mean, I think the other part that I've become more conscious of, especially the last few years, is it doesn't just come with a financial cost, although it absolutely does, but it also comes with this health cost of you often have less control over the ingredients that go into something. And of course, there's a lot more like fantastic organic options on the market and things like that. But oftentimes the food that you buy that's processed and prepackaged just isn't going to be quite as healthy as what you could make. And of course, that doesn't mean that you need to beat yourself up and go make everything from scratch, right? Don't go into your backyard and start growing your wheat, right? There's reasonable lines here. But I think it's something that is frustrating for me as a consumer because it's harder to find these things that are healthy and good for our bodies and our souls and all of that. But it's something that if you care about what goes into your products, right, whether that's the food you eat, the shampoo bars you use, it's going to take a little bit more work on the upfront to find solutions that work for you.
So I feel like, Jennifer, a lot of the things you've talked about today have been more passive, like be on social media less, watch less TV, you know, raise your children right. But what I love about your writing is that there's also an active component as well. So my penultimate question to you today is about the active changes. So if we are really not on board with convenience culture on the large scale, how can we actively work to change it? And specifically, I'm asking with regard to the policy changes that we should be supporting, not only with our money, but also with our votes.
Absolutely. So I think that changing culture with our dollars is actually pretty straightforward. You can decide what values are most important to you, and then you can do everything in your power to support companies that put their money where their mouth is. And so there's a lot of certifications that'll help you to do that, like Fair Trade or B Corp. If you're caring about fair labor, ESG issues, if you're worried about plastic waste, you can look for items that are low waste, that are in recyclable or compostable packaging, things like that. And that can get really kind of nitty gritty. And so, for example, my girls, their dolls and their stuffed animals are all ones with organic cotton exteriors, corn fiber filling. That's actually a really not a particularly easy thing to find. But it was really important to me when they're so little that that's something they have. And so we only support a couple of companies for their dolls and stuffed animals, right? That's it. And so those are decisions that you get to make for your own life, your own family. Voting is where it gets more complicated because there's so many issues at stake. But I would really push elected officials to consider the ways that we can hold corporations accountable. So in economics, there's this term known as a negative externality. It's basically all the bad things that can happen based off of a decision that a person or a corporation makes that they don't actually have to pay for. And so let's say for a moment that I'm a manufacturing plant that's emitting air pollution. This air pollution might increase the risk of cancer for everybody around me, but I'm not personally responsible for paying those medical bills. And so that's a cost, right, that falls onto society as a whole, or the individual who lives near my plant who gets cancer, even if they have never purchased my product, even if they never worked in my plant, have anything to do with me. And so the role of regulation is to try to manage these negative externalities. And so the the big externality right now for consumer culture and convenience culture is, of course, the carbon emissions of all of the shipping. But the other one is single-use packaging. And it's not enough to slap a recycling symbol on a plastic bottle and call it a day. Some companies are even offering mail-in recycling, typically in partnership with an organization like TerraCycle, which I know you've talked about before, for traditionally hard-to-recycle items like a coffee pot or a Febreze container. But even that isn't enough for a couple of reasons. The first is it puts this enormous burden on consumers to store these items, box them up, print off a shipping label. Like, it's all this stuff, right? It actually feels overwhelming just even saying it out loud, right? But if you kept trying to like buy your items off of a standard supermarket shelf, you could easily end up trying to collect 15 or 20 different like waste streams here. And then kind of the second part is it's really not the solution. Right. And so most of these items get downcycled, right? So we think, oh, if I send in this item to be recycled, it'll become a new plastic bottle, right? And that's very rarely the case. It often becomes, you know, insulation somewhere or the filling for a carpet or something that isn't quite so easily recyclable. And so things aren't, if they're plastic, infinitely recyclable. There's something that's only recyclable once or twice in a very best case scenario. And so what we really need to be pushing for is a system, right, that redesigns our packaging and our food to things that are compostable and to truly recyclable, things like glass or aluminum. And honestly, a lot of these changes are happening at a local level too. So these changes aren't all things that are happening at a federal or a state level. So those elections absolutely matter. But I think that the places where those are complicated, right, is because there's so many issues at stake. But individual cities are also moving to do things like ban styrofoam or implement taxes on plastic bags. Moving at such a local level can actually be really enormously confusing for companies because they're having to navigate lots of things that are happening at each of their different store locations. But it's a great pressure point for voters who care about these issues. It tells us to pay attention to local elections, to local advocacy, to say that like what happens at the mayor or the city commissioner level can really move the bar in your local community. And if a company that has, you know, only a few locations, if they can't have plastic bags in your town, maybe they'll get rid of them one town over because that's just easier for them logistically too.
I agree with all of that. And that was such a comprehensive answer, Jennifer. Thank you. I just want to add a little tip as well that I think you touched on, but let's just say it out loud. I think it really comes down to paying attention, keeping yourself informed, diversifying the information sources from which you get your information. So not only CNN, not only Fox News, let's diversify where we're getting our information. And even if, especially in the environmental sphere, even though the information may not be good news, we still need to not turn away. Like we need to be paying attention all the time. And I feel like, especially in topics of environmentalism, the push to like turn away and just not, I can't deal with it. I can't look. I can't hear about it anymore today is strong. But always go back and always stay informed. I think that's really darn important because otherwise, if we're not staying informed, then consumer culture, excessive consumerism is just going to be pushed on us blindly.
I think what's powerful about that, too, is this idea that what you do impacts not just yourself and your household, but people around you. And so if you're making these changes to be more intentional, to resist consumer culture, to make a low-waste lifestyle change, whatever it is, those are things that your friends and neighbors are going to notice. And that does not mean that they're going to jump out tomorrow and do the exact same thing. But what it does do is it allows this space for them to be like, well, there's another way. Right? There's a way that's more intentional, that's kinder to the environment. And it gives this opening for other people to pursue that in their own lives as well.
That's a perfect place to leave it. Why don't you tell us, Jennifer, where we can get more of you online?
Absolutely. So I run an online newsletter called Sustain Initiative. To be honest, the easiest way to find me is actually just to Google the phrase Sustain Initiative on Substack. Test it. I'm pretty sure that's the fastest way to get to my website. But you can also go directly to jennifernewton.substack.com, and that'll get you to the exact same place. And this will give you access to all of my previous posts, as well as the option to subscribe to my content, which is all about taking small and intentional steps towards a life that's safer for our families and kinder to the planet.
And your content, your creations, let's say, are 10 out of 10, Jennifer. So thank you so much for putting it into the world. And thank you so much for your time. We definitely went over time today, but I really enjoyed it. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure talking to you.
Listeners, that's a wrap, my friends. Show notes are at mamaminimalist.com/449. And yes, I have included a link to Jennifer's Substack in this week's show notes because it is kind of weirdly hard to find if you're not already on Substack. But it's worth it. Now, we have so many eco tips. They've been coming through after my plea from last week. Last week, I said, send me your eco tips. And you guys, it came out. Thank you so much. Today's eco tip is relevant to today's conversation. And it comes from an anonymous Instagram friendship. If we're against excessive consumption, if we're against materialism, this eco tip speaks to that. And it is, of course, to complement a quality of a person instead of their material belongings. So, thank you. You are such a kind human being, as opposed to, oh my goodness, I love your shirt, or oh my goodness, great bag, right? Use discernment, because if you compliment their physical body, some people might take that offensively. They might even consider it an advance. But you could say, I really like how you're always thinking of other people, or I really like how your brain works, or I really like how I can tell you're listening when I talk. If we're complimenting a person for who they are, as opposed to what they put on their body, that can perhaps make people feel that they are enough just the way they are. They may not be as susceptible to buying things from advertisers if we're propping up their being, right? They may not be as susceptible to the, oh, you're not this, you're lacking this, you need this, if we're propping up people for who they are. So this anonymous eco tip writer, they remember one day recently they wanted to compliment on someone's beautiful jewelry, but they paused. And the person they were talking to later in the conversation complimented their music, right? Their content, their creation. And they said that it felt like a higher and more meaningful and lasting compliment than simply commenting on the handbag or the pedicure or the new hairdo, let's say. So amazing eco tip. Wow. Something we can all do for free with very little effort and passively push back against consumption culture, materialism culture, and excessive convenience culture. So thank you so much to my anonymous eco tip writer. I love it. And everybody else, you got an eco tip? There's no eco tip too small or too silly. We take them all here. Okay, we take them all. So send them my way. The way to do that's in the show notes. We'll be back on Thursday. I will see you then. I hope I made your day brighter. That's my goal. I'll see you Thursday and take care.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise. Having fun in the sun or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.